welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rurink, Jack Spencer, Mike Malott, and our special guest this week, Kathy Barks Hoffman from Martin Wehmeyer. A little later, we're going to have Brandon Dillon from the WinMat Group joining us, and also Lori Pahutsky, state representative from Livonia. But Kathy, thanks for making the trip over here. Good to see you again.
Yeah, nice to see you too.
Well, we're going to talk presidential politics a little later, but the first thing I wanted to talk about was State Representative Karen Whitsitt last week on WWJ calling House Minority Leader Christine Gregg a racist. And while we haven't had an amen really necessarily from anybody in the caucus about that particular use of the word, I think it does show some fissures within the Democratic House caucus. And in that regard, what's new? Mike, I want to start here with you on this because from watching the Democratic caucus, it seems like as much as there's always an attempt to get everyone together on the same page, it always seems like there's at least four or five people don't make it into caucus. And it's just, again, another example of how it's hard to unify the House Democratic caucus. Why do you think that is?
Well, there's a number of factors. The Democratic caucus is more diverse. They're representing different kinds of areas. You've got representatives from the Ann Arbor area, and they have one level of interest. And you've got people from inner cities in Flint and Detroit who have a whole different set of issues and priorities. So they have to come together and find some kind of an agenda to push, and that's not easy to do. Plus, they're in the minority. It's very difficult to advance an agenda. The best way to advance your agenda as a Democrat in the House is to find a Republican that you can agree with on something. And so the Democratic agenda is not being pushed. You're trying to find something that you can agree with the majority on. It's very difficult to hold a caucus together like that, and it's kind of understandable.
When you look at what Karen Whitsitt's problem was, initially she came in and she was upset that the Democrats didn't have an urban agenda. But when you're in the minority, like the Democrats are, pushing an urban agenda as a main caucus position isn't going to get you necessarily majority. And so while the Democrats in Detroit would really like to see more done to try and help their community, that isn't going to play statewide, and that's been an historical issue, hasn't it, Kathy?
Yeah, we were talking about 2006 when Diane Byrom was the House Democratic leader. They were in the minority, and she basically got them to only talk about two issues. We got tired of covering it. We said, we're not going to go to another news conference about Canadian trash. But she had that, and she had prescription drugs. She came up with two issues that basically everybody in the caucus could get behind, and then she really didn't allow them to talk about anything else.
No.
And they won the majority in that election in 2006, and she just, you know, she knew that you just had to drill down, come up with something that was going to unify the caucus. You know, I'm sure they had all their other internal issues still going on, but that the way to get the public's attention was to come up with two things that they knew the voters would agree on. And it did work.
So, Jack, you've watched this happen as our House reporter for several years, too. And I think you remember, I think what encapsulates it in your mind is a conversation you had with our old friend, the late Aldo Vagnozzi.
Yes, and Aldo came up with the quote, I think it was almost quote of the year that year, that the difference between a caucus and a cactus was that the cactuses have the pricks on the outside. And this was when they had majority. Yeah. That he said this, and they were trying to get 10 Republicans to vote for the tax hike and all this because they didn't. I mean, this was just, and I heard other people that talking about how much worse the arguing was inside the caucus than it ever was on the House floor.
Part of the problem here, too, for Christine Gregg, John, I got to imagine, is the fact that she's in the minority and not in the majority. So if Karen Whitsitt decides to vote with Republicans on the first vote for the auto no fault, because she feels like she's doing what's best for her district, she's representing her district and she feels like this is best for her district, Christine Gregg can't do anything necessarily to punish her.
No, there's no way for her to punish her. I think what a lot of this gets back down to is the impact of term limits. I mean, when we started covering the House in 96, Every caucus has had its fissures, its personality conflicts. But the difference then was you didn't go out and pick up a public cudgel and swing at your leader. It was usually handled, I mean, there might have been some kerfuffles on the floor, but it was generally handled behind the scenes. Again, this is it's a fairly new member to the House, dealing with a very limited, in terms of power and tenure, leader. So she followed the example of today's politics of Trumpism and picked up a microphone and went out and made some accusations that have now gotten lots of attention.
What I think is interesting here in the story with Karen Whitsitt is that we have problems not only with the leader, but there's problems within the Democratic Detroit caucus here with Cynthia Johnson basically calling out Karen Whitsitt in public. And it really puts a focus on how when we had the election in 2018, we had the Mike Duggan crew, the folks that Mike Duggan supported, who wanted to do kind of maybe a compromise version of No Fault, which is exactly what ended up happening. And then there was that core group of folks in Detroit who are still bent on the whole redlining issue and that we should make the entire state of Michigan one rating category, as opposed to doing it by zip codes or doing it by cities or whatever. That is what they want. They want the perfect as opposed to the good, and that still has created some issues within the Detroit caucus. I saw you nodding your head over here.
Well, I just think there's always going to be issues. I can certainly understand Representative Whitsitt's position on, you know, the auto no fault. I don't think that bill was perfect, but I think that people in Detroit felt very seriously that, you know, people couldn't even, you know, afford auto insurance in Detroit. So it was a big vote. You know, the problem is, like you said, the Dems have been out of power for a while now. The Republicans are, even with the Democratic governor, are flexing their muscle in the House and doing everything they can generally represent their point of view. There isn't much room for the Democrats to have any bandwidth here.
So then we get into this old argument, Mike. Is it better if you're in the minority to stand up against the Republicans and tell your constituents, I just went ahead and voted no and I'm steadfast in saying no? Or is it better to do kind of the Harvey Santana approach and say, you know what, we didn't get everything we wanted, but you know what, I got us a few $100,000 for a swimming pool. I did the best that we possibly could. I got a couple of amendments and this is what we got. It's better than nothing.
When you're in the minority, you get your compromises where you can. And one of the things that you have to remember about that auto no fault was that Karen Whitsitt actually got several amendments that made the bill much better for Democrats. And the Democrats continued to oppose that bill and gave her absolutely zero credit for the improvements that she made to the bill. She was one of only three Democratic votes for that. And the caucus generally still hated that bill. So she got some wins and has gotten no credit for it. I can see where that would make you ornery.
It kind of goes back, Jack, to the whole argument of, is it better to do maybe practical improvements, or is it better to use this as a political tool to maybe be of an advantage later? And, you know, Karen Whitsitt is not a creature of political politics. You know, when I've covered the caucus meetings before in Detroit, Karen Whitsitt is not one of the people who have been traditionally there and have been trying to politicize this issue. I think she was looking at it more from a practical standpoint, and that's something that you get no matter where you are, whether you're in Detroit or anywhere else.
Possibly, but I don't know about the practicality of calling your caucus leader a racist. I just keep thinking here what Kathy said about keeping it simple. If you're having that much problems, if it's that difficult, if you really stop and think about it, that does make sense. Pick a couple of things, even if they're very simplistic, even if it kind of challenges your intellect to say, I've come this far and I'm going to pluck out two obvious things. At least it's better if you can get a couple of simplistic things that everybody or almost everybody in your caucus agrees to, then let the other things arrange themselves where people go. I can see where that might be the better formula to follow.
What would those issues be, John? Healthcare seems to be a unifying factor within the Democrats, and among Democratic voters, it's their top issue.
Yeah, prescription drugs prices is a great example where you could do a rally point. There's lots of different issues that you can go to.
Kathy, do you have any ideas? Where would you go if you were the House Minority Leader right now?
I feel a little snarky because I didn't think a whole lot of the Canadian trash issue at the time.
But it worked.
And it was a big issue. I mean, people do care about the fact that the Canadians, and they still are bringing trash into the state. But so I don't know. Maybe there's another trash, you know, Canadian trash redux that we can do or something like that.
We have to say also, 06 was a good Democratic year across the country, too. Don't forget that.
Right.
But they were in a good position, I would argue, because Byram had done it the way she did it. So it's kind of like, if you do it and you hit a great Republican year, it probably won't work. But if you do it and you hit a more even year, then you have a lot better chance.
Well, with that, we're going to bring in our next guest from the WinMAC group, Brandon Dillon. Somehow you avoided the conversation on the House Democratic Caucus, but we've got...
I like them all.
as a former member, also a former Michigan Democratic Party chair, and obviously you've been watching what's going on with Michigan politics. I thought, first of all, you could give our listeners a little educational lesson on superdelegates. And can you tell our listeners when superdelegates are kind of factored into this whole equation of carving out the delegates in the Democratic Party?
Yeah, the superdelegates have gotten a lot of attention in the last 4 years, particularly after the 2016 campaign when Hillary Clinton had amassed a bunch of commitments from superdelegates, which are essentially members of Congress and members of the DNC and other high-level party officials.
How many are we talking in Michigan, just Michigan?
In Michigan, you got your congressional delegation and the DNC members. I don't know the total. I've heard about 30, I would guess.
And is Whitmer a superdelegate?
She's not.
Oh.
She would not be. I don't believe the governors are. I'd have to go back and check. But it's generally the congressionals, your United States senator, and any members that are on the Democratic National Committee from your state. So actually, it's probably more like 20.
Okay, so when do they factor into the equation in this whole selection process?
Yeah, the new thing this year at the convention will be the rule that the DNC adopted is superdelegates will not be able to cast a ballot unless there is a second ballot. So going into the convention, you won't have a list of committed delegates that include superdelegates. If none of the candidates, which it looks increasingly likely, walks into Milwaukee with an absolute majority of pledged delegates, then it's very possible, unless there's some maneuvering behind the scenes where folks give up their delegates to other candidates or drop out, that the superdelegates will weigh in on the second ballot to push one of the candidates over the top.
Now, explain, how many delegates do we have in the state of Michigan, and kind of in layman's terms, how are they cut up?
You are asking questions that I've tried to forget as my time as Democratic Party chair. But essentially, after the primary, candidates that get to that 15% viability threshold in any one congressional district will be allotted a certain amount of delegates based on their performance on primary night. And then they'll go through and get elected at local district and county conventions. Then there's a certain amount of delegates that are allocated at the statewide level. The Democratic Party has a series of goals that you are required to try to reach in terms of representation from African American community, women, the LGBT community, Arab American community. So a lot of times if the vote at the district level doesn't achieve that, then there's an opportunity with a statewide delegate selection done at the State Central Committee of the party to even that out a bit.
So they are elected then by congressional district. Okay, so if, let's say, Bernie Sanders wins the 8th, but Joe Biden wins the 7th, then Joe Biden gets the ones from the 7th district.
That's correct. There is also a statewide portion that I believe you get, but it's mostly done on congressional district, and you have to get to that level of viability. So you could have a great night in the 5th congressional district and win 100%, get all the delegates there, and then this probably wouldn't happen, but not get 15% in any other congressional district and not get any delegates there. So it tends to come out, if you recall, when Clinton and Sanders ran in 16, the delegates allocation was only like two different, and the statewide vote was so close. So it tends to mirror that, but the potential is that you could get kind of a different results in those different congressional districts based on strength, and it might not necessarily reflect the overall statewide vote.
And Michigan has how many Democratic delegates?
I think it's 125 pledged delegates. Now, I don't know if that's the superdelegates included in that or not.
I don't know if it is.
But it did say 125 that are at stake on during our vote on March 10th.
Yeah. Right.
Now, how many superdelegates are there compared to the other delegates? Would you be adding 10% more, 25% more? What are we talking about here?
I think it's about between 10 and 20%. Is where it is. So most of the time, up until 2016, the superdelegates really never have, well, frankly, even then, have never had any determinative role at the convention. They've really followed the path of the leader and pledge delegates. This could be the first time, depending on the dynamics going into Milwaukee, where they could put a candidate over the top that doesn't come into the convention with the overall lead and pledge delegates, whether it's a plurality.
Now, what do you think? If Bernie comes in just a little shy on the first ballot, that's going to be awful hard to deny him that, wouldn't you say?
There's no doubt. I mean, I think it really is going to depend on, first of all, I think it would be very difficult to deny a candidate the nomination if they come in extremely close to the overall threshold to win. If it's a situation where you have two candidates coming in and they're separated by a couple dozen delegates or something very small, then I think it's a different story. But I do think if Bernie Sanders walks into the convention in Milwaukee with a significant lead in pledged delegates and walks out of there without the nomination, it'll be an interesting time in Milwaukee afterwards. Let's just put it that way.
Well, we have to remember that Republicans will be voting as well. They have 73 delegates, and they do win or take all if you're over the majority, which Trump, of course, will probably win. So that's easy enough, but we will have Republicans going to the polls as well on March 10th. The other thing that's a big factor is that a third of the delegates nationwide are going to be picked by Super Tuesday. And that's the week before. So it'll be really interesting to see where Michigan sits after that. You know, does Bernie Sanders take so much of the votes there that he's seen as a runaway candidate by the time he gets here? I mean, he did narrowly win against Hillary Clinton, who was clearly seen as the favorite last time. And so he does know how to work the Michigan system as far as getting delegates. But we also have to sit there and say, who else maybe has dropped out by then? All these candidates are on the ballot. Most of them have dropped out. But I expect that probably you will have a few more that will drop out after South Carolina and after Super Tuesday. So how many candidates are Michigan voters really going to have as viable choice? And then I think a lot is going to change with being able to vote absentee and being able to register right up until the day. I mean, I think I was seeing something that was saying they've already come up with 70% more absentee ballots by last week than they had before. So, I mean, a lot of people are voting absentee. Have those people voted before already, you know, and then will they have to go in and spoil their ballots and get a new ballot? You know, I mean, there's just lots of unknowns this time around. And I just think that's going to make it really interesting here.
I think that's one of the things that's going to be interesting about Michigan this year is coming right there the week after Super Tuesday. We don't know yet if that's going to be an afterthought or if that's going to be super important. It's going to be really interesting to watch, see how that plays out.
Yeah, we could be an afterthought, John.
It wouldn't be the first time Michigan's been an afterthought, unfortunately.
I actually think it's going to play a fairly significant role because I think it's difficult to imagine that Super Tuesday actually getting total clarity. There's still a number of large states that will be voting after Super Tuesday, Michigan included, a lot of the industrial Midwestern states. But you're going to see, and then the California vote is not going to, we're not going to know the California vote, even though people have started to vote now until well after Super Tuesday because of how they calculate the ballots and the amount of time it takes people to come in. So I still think there's going to be a very important role for Michigan to play. And I think at this point, if you don't have an operation on the ground in Michigan and you haven't been working, you're going to have a very difficult time carrying the state precisely because of the fact that so many ballots are going to already be cast by Election Day. People can go in and change their vote. But, you know, I was looking at my ballot the other day and Joe Sestak is still on there. I don't know that anybody voted for him, but I just don't see a lot of people who have voted, have made that decision to vote, going back and saying, oh, I want to change my vote. It'll be a very small amount of people that do that.
As a former party chair, I would love to hear your take on the sort of the Michael Bloomberg effect and kind of coming in late, coming in with a ton of money. What odds do you give him?
Well, a little bit of disclosure. My brother is working for Bloomberg, but I am not. He is working in a paid position for Bloomberg, but I am not. Look, I think he's shaken up the race in many ways. The question is, you know, money is increasingly important, and it makes a difference. He's been able to make a big splash, particularly if you look at some of the polls in the Super Tuesday states, where he's leading in Florida, I think he's leading in Virginia, he's in second in New Jersey. So some of these big states with a lot of delegates, he's really started to rise. The question is, can he amass enough delegates on Super Tuesday to slow the lead that Sanders looks like he is going to amass in those states? But look, I think they've got a pretty strong operation in the state. They're talking to people. I'm bombarded by messages from the Bloomberg campaign, as I know a lot of other people are. But I would rather be in a position like Mike Bloomberg with an operation going in the state, even though it's his campaign's only gotten started, as opposed to somebody like Mayor Pete or Klobuchar, who, if they stay in past Super Tuesday, are going to have nothing going on in Michigan.
Can he recover from his performance last week? I mean, the national pundits are like, oh, he's dead, he's done, he's over. And I'm not so sure that's right.
I don't believe that. You know, we thought a number of times after Trump's bizarre debate performances in 2016, the national pundits, everybody said, oh, he's done, he can't be done. I think it definitely hurt. It showed that he wasn't prepared for that and didn't have crisp answers to some of the pretty obvious questions and criticisms that were going to come his way. But look, between the last debate and the next debate on Tuesday, he probably spent $70 to $100 million making people forget about his debate performance. And the media loves a comeback story. If he has a good performance tomorrow in South Carolina, I think he can change it, but he's going to have to be significantly, significantly better than what he was.
Another thing is that you have to declare a party when you go vote in Michigan's presidential primary, but you don't. You can pick either ballot. So, you know, that's the issue, too, is do Republicans who already know that Trump's going to win, do they cross over? And there's been some history of that in Michigan. And if they cross over, do they cross over to pick Bernie Sanders because they think he's a weaker candidate, or do they pick somebody else? I don't think you'll see a significant amount of that, but there's no reason to vote in the Republican primary, basically, because I can't imagine that President Trump is not going to win the Michigan Republican primary. You know, so we could see some of that. And we've had a history of that going back decades of where people have crossed over. I mean, George Wallace winning back, you know, in the 60s here was definitely a crossover issue. So there has been a history of this. And this is kind of one of those perfect elections where, okay, so somebody marks you down as a Democrat, you're really a Republican. It doesn't really matter.
You don't even have to go that far back. I mean, John McCain, you could argue. You could also argue Jesse Jackson back in, what was that, 88? So, I mean, we have a strong history of doing that. So I would imagine there's all sorts of Republicans. If you're a Republican, who do you vote for? Do you vote for Bernie Sanders? Do you vote for...
I'm not so sure Bernie Sanders is necessarily the weakest candidate, though.
Well, I agree with that, but I think there's a lot of Republicans that think he's easy to beat. So I think they may support
them. Yeah, you're nodding your head over here, Brandon.
Yeah, look, I think there's definite concerns, particularly amongst Democrats, about the Sanders candidacy and the effect it will have on down-ballot candidates. I agree. I think it's much too early. And if you look at polling, which is the only real kind of evidence we have of somebody's viability, that is not borne out that he is the weakest candidate. In fact, in many polls, he's the strongest candidate. The concern, I think, and I think where maybe some Republicans see the advantage, is that the Sanders appeal is not necessarily seem like, at least at this point, it's going to help Democrats in swing suburban districts, whether it's for Congress or the Michigan House. I think he is yet to show that he's able to get support from kind of those suburban, independent, progressive-leaning women that have increasingly, you know, been part of the Democratic coalition and put Gretchen Whitmer really over the top in both the primary and the general election. But look, everybody wrote off Trump, said he was going to be divisive and they were going to lose seats. I mean, Lindsey Graham said he'd be a total disaster for the party, and now Lindsey Graham is his best friend. So you never know what's going to happen. The voters will ultimately make the decision. But I think you're entering uncharted waters with the self-proclaimed socialist, Democratic socialist running on the ballot, who has never taken any real hits on his record. And a lot of money from a Trump campaign, I think, worries some Democrats who believe that we cannot afford to lose this election in any way.
Yeah, and if you're Alyssa Slotkin now and Bernie Sanders is your nominee, you got to be focusing now on getting turnout at Michigan State University, Oakland University. And then likewise, if you're a state House candidate, now you got to be starting to look like you got to start looking at college towns like now Mount Pleasant, for example. Maybe now is the year that that Mount Pleasant seat finally. I know you're rolling your eyes on this because I know that's been fool's gold for Democrats for every election for the last 10. But I mean, it's a different universe of people now you're tapping into because now you're not going for the moderates. Now it becomes a turnout election.
Well, I think it was always going to be a turnout election. One thing you can say about Trump is he doesn't provide a lot of room for squishy feelings. Either really like him or you despise him. And I think, you know, you may see the same with a Bernie Sanders. His supporters are incredibly loyal and vocal and have a lot of energy and will go out and do the work. The people that don't like him really don't like him. And that goes across the general electorate as well. So I think it's going to be a turnout election in many ways. I think Democratic voters are motivated. But in Michigan, you still can't win with just getting out your base. You have to appeal to independent voters. There are enough of them in Michigan that can make the difference. And they tend to be in districts that I don't know if the Sanders message, the uncompromising message, is going to appeal to them.
The other problem that people have been talking about, though, with the Sanders voters is if he doesn't get the nomination, a lot of them say, according to polls, well, then I'm not going to be showing up for anybody else. So you have this dynamic, too, which is kind of like an extra barb in the side of, at least theoretically, of how you look and how you evaluate this whole Democratic process as when it comes down to picking a nominee.
Kathy, obviously you've been a reporter with the Associated Press for many years. How many election, presidential election contests have you been through, and does this one in particular remind you of any one in particular?
I've got to date myself, but I think I did at least 8 where I went to conventions. And generally with whatever the governor, whatever that party was, I would go to that convention. I think that there's always a lot of angst when Democrats can't come together behind somebody right away. And they never do because they are a very diverse party. You said Jesse Jackson, you know, and I mean, lots of different people. I mean, even Hillary Clinton, there was a lot of bad feeling, even in the Democratic Party, about are you for Hillary or aren't you for Hillary? And people, I think, were really torn by things like this. And so I personally think that it all works out in the end. You know, there is a process and it is messy. And, you know, the alternative here is that we go back to making these decisions in smoke-filled rooms with a few people that decide how things look. And yeah. So Brendan's all for it. Yeah. But that's the reason we've moved to more and more transparency here and more public participation. And it is extremely messy. And it's gotten even harder in a time of social media because, you know, you can just kind of blast out what you want to blast out. There's no more gatekeepers. So somebody like, you know, Bernie can get really strong. I mean, Trump, this is what helped Trump so much. He was very good on social media and he could get his message out. That's what keeping him strong. So we're in a time where there's a whole lot of different factors here. It's not just that the public has more of a say, the voters have more of a say, it's that the messaging is so just instant and all the time. And I mean, Bloomberg would be an asterisk at this point if he didn't have a way of getting his message out. And he's not just doing it on the airwaves, he's doing it through social media and, you know, a lot of these ads online and things like that. So I think that that's kind of the difference this time. But I also think it's not that different because there just always is a lot of angst when the parties, either one of them, can't come up with a clear front winner. And everybody's like, oh, my God, we're going to lose. And it's like, you know, eventually you get to the point where you have somebody. And then I don't know what the Bernie bros are going to do. And if they stay home this time, I think there's going to be a lot of anger in the Democratic Party. But in general, people get behind their nominee.
Well, I wanted to ask you this question then, Brandon. I appreciate you bringing up the Bernie bros because, Brandon, I want to ask you, do you think the Bernie bros are a benefit or are they a hindrance to the Democratic Party right now?
Well, they're a hindrance to Senator Sanders. I mean, I know that this does not apply to the vast majority of people who are supporting Bernie Sanders. Most of them are just people who are, you know, find somebody that they like his message and they feel like maybe other people haven't spoken to their issues. But there is a not insignificant amount of people that populate social media who are, in fact, horrible. They attack, even when you don't say anything particularly negative about this, about Senator Sanders, but you might, you know, have questions about a position. It is 100% ride or die. And if you're not on it, then you're a sellout or a corporate shill. I don't expect Senator Sanders to control those folks. You can't control everybody, especially, as Kathy said, in their social media, where people can be anonymous, and then you don't know what messages are actually generally organically produced, or might be some sort of campaign from, you know, Russian bots to kind of sow discord in the electorate. But I do think Bernie has not been strong enough in coming out and saying that he absolutely rejects any of these kind of tactics. He's said a few things, but he needs to come out strong, because it is going to produce a lot of resentment with people who may not be 100% supportive of Bernie, but will line up and support him as the nominee. But it's going to make it difficult for those folks to do anything other than just cast their ballot if they're constantly attacked by saying anything that is even mildly critical of him or his record.
And the example that I want to bring out for our podcast listeners is this Wall Street fundraiser that Joe Biden did, in which some Bernie bros brought a casket to the front of the fundraiser to have a mock funeral for Joe Biden's campaign.
Yeah, it's just stupid and childish. I mean, it's frankly, I don't understand the strategy behind it. In fact, as I was watching the debate last time, what you said, Kyle, reminds me. I mean, any time a Democratic candidate for president is not taking any question, when you have 2 hours of national primetime TV and turning it into a criticism of the Trump administration or a contrast between their position and what Trump is currently doing as president, is a total and utter waste of time. The vast majority of Democrats want not only somebody who they can feel comfortable with, but frankly, somebody who can beat Trump. And if you're constantly fighting amongst yourselves and you have a sideshow with Mayor Pete and Senator Klobuchar in the debate the last time that just seemed bizarre given what the stakes are in this election, I would hope that folks would understand that you will have a vigorous primary, and it's a good place to get out some of these issues, because God knows whoever the nominee is going to face 10 times worse from the Trump machine.
Well, I just have to comment on the smoke-filled rooms. I mean, every place is smoke-free now. I mean, we've put that one, that's dead and buried.
Well, you can have a vape room.
Vape-filled room. But what interests me on this, let's say somehow it ends up being Bloomberg and Trump. It makes me think ahead, okay, what are we going to have from now on with the two parties? My billionaire versus your billionaire? Who could have ever predicted any of this stuff just as short a time ago as even 6 years ago?
I was just going to say, the problem with the Bernie bros, in addition to what Brendan said, is quite frankly, they're like some of the most avid Trump supporters. I mean, they're just on the opposite side of the spectrum, but they're the same way. It's like there's no allowance of anybody else having an opinion that's valid or reasonable. It's just that they throw different criticisms than the far right does. But it really is not a good sign if we're trying to eventually get back to where we can discuss things with each other, because we're not really moving that way, I don't think, at least on some of this.
You run the risk then, I guess, if Bernie is elected, of replacing one bully with another?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that, because I do think for all of Senator Sanders' challenges in terms of his personality and his kind of uncompromising style, there is certainly a significant difference between the way he views democracy and I think the way Trump has carried himself as president. So no, I don't think there's any equivalencies there. I do agree, though, the folks that are almost cult-like in their devotion to both Senator Sanders and on the right, Donald Trump, are just not willing to accept anything that diverts from their preconceived narrative on how the world is or how it should be. And I don't have as much confidence that we're going to get back to normal, because I don't see any change in the fundamentals that are making that possible, whether it's the elimination of traditional broadcast media as the source of people's news, the rise of social media and the kind of anonymity, the explosion of money in politics, and the ability of dark money groups to be able to play a role. So, boy, I hope so. But I think we shouldn't be waiting for, the perfect political figure to come out and change that. It's going to require people making changes to the system that are allowing this, that are rewarding this type of behavior.
I don't even know if it's possible with the social media. I mean, look, we're talking about trolls. We're talking about these people that, regardless of what side, I mean, you can be with them on 19 to 20 subjects, and it's just one subject, and you're horrible. And I think that's a very huge concern.
And now we're going to go to our interview with Representative Lori Pahutsky, the Democrat from Livonia. All right, joining me this week for the podcast is Representative Lori Pohutsky from Livonia. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. This is very exciting.
Thanks for having me. It is.
All right. So I happen to see on my Twitter that you had a picture of a possum, and possums are very ugly.
I think that they're adorable.
What?
Actually.
Are you kidding me?
No, no. I love possums.
How?
They're scrappy. They're scrappy, and they, you know, deal with ticks, and I think they're adorable.
They're more adorable than raccoons?
They're less mean than raccoons in general, so
that
yeah.
That is true.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
is true.
I think possums have an advantage.
I know, but I only see possums on the side of the road.
I mean, that's fair. That's fair. But
okay, but so tell our listeners why you posted the picture of a possum.
You know, with 2020 ramping up, I had a couple people who were clearly involved in the Republican Party here in Michigan following me, I'm assuming looking for attack ads or something like that, which is kind of silly because it's a public verified page. There's nothing up there that I'm worried about being used against me. So I just said that every time one of them followed me, I was going to retweet from an account that posts a picture of a possum every hour.
How often have you done it now?
I believe only twice. So,
but you're ready to do it more.
Oh, absolutely. I get one every hour. You know, I follow that account, so I have ample material.
Did you have a stuffed possum as a kid or something?
I did not, actually, no.
Okay.
No.
I'm just trying to figure this out. Why are Republicans always why are Republicans focusing on you in the 19th district?
You know, it was a narrow margin of votes that I won by. It was not expected. So I think that they're just trying to look for anything they can do to get the seat back is all.
They probably think you're too liberal for this district.
Maybe. I hear that sometimes. I don't think I'm actually that out there, but the fact that I was elected also suggests that that's not the case. But I have heard that theory, yes.
What are you hearing from the people in your district when you're talking to them? What are they interested about, and what kind of feedback are you getting from them?
Sure. So we knocked a lot of legislative doors last year. So those are just issues-based doors where I check in with folks and see what's going on with them, if they have any concerns about what's going on in Lansing, give them an update. And obviously roads were a big topic of conversation last year. I expect this year it will be the same thing, particularly with the governor's plan, you know, with the bonding and things like that. But consistently, even when I was campaigning, the environment was a huge one, which was great because I was a scientist, so that was in my wheelhouse. It was something I was very comfortable talking about. But water quality, invasive species, contamination issues, things like that are really on everyone's mind, including in my district. Even though we don't have drinking water contamination, we do have a groundwater contamination issue. But, you know, we don't have a large body of water near us or anything like that. But I just think that goes to show how important that issue is to everyone across the state.
Is guns mentioned at all?
Not so much. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, occasionally people, you know, tell me that they either are concerned about gun violence or there are people who are worried about their Second Amendment rights. Things like that, but it's not a huge issue, no. And it's just not something that I've heard a whole lot about from people.
And the reason I ask is because with the election of your mayor there in Livonia, it does seem like Livonia is becoming a bit more Democratic. And I'm trying to figure out why that is. What are the issues that are moving the people in Livonia that are kind of responsible for this trend that we're seeing?
I think it's more of a demographic shift, in all honesty. So Livonia has a housing market that's kind of created a huge influx of millennials. So I think that the people who are living in Livonia are starting to look a lot different than they were elections prior to this one. I try not to focus on the national level because that's not what I'm doing here. I work in the state. But I think that that is also kind of shifting how people are looking at things. Absolutely.
So one of the bills that you have introduced with some of your cohorts is in regard to sexual education. Mm-hmm. Tell our listeners what you're doing and why you're pursuing this.
Sure. So there were three bills that were introduced by myself, Representative Hood, and Representative Wittenberg. Mine is a bill that mandates that public schools, as part of their HIV/AIDS curriculum, also discuss medically accurate information about PEP and PrEP, which is post-exposure prophylaxis and pre-exposure prophylaxis around HIV and AIDS exposure.
So what does that mean? I'm trying to figure out what those words mean, too.
Sure. So PEP is often administered after cases of assault or if there's a reason to believe that you may have been exposed to HIV or AIDS after an encounter. PrEP is something that people can take if they have reason to believe that they may end up being exposed or if they are in a relationship with someone who has HIV or AIDS. So it's just a matter of, you know, expanding the knowledge base of the available options that people have and things that people should be aware of just in case they ever need either of those drugs.
Where did these bills come from? What was kind of the impetus behind them?
So I was talking with my legislative director, actually, about a story where a young person had inadvertently been exposed to HIV/AIDS and ended up contracting it. And it was one of those times where if that information had been made available to that high school student as part of his health class, there may have been a way to avoid that eventual diagnosis.
Interesting. Is this the first time you know of this particular bill being introduced? I don't know if I've seen it before.
As far as I know, yeah, it's the first time. I'm not sure about other states, but I believe here in our legislature, yeah, it's the first time.
If you could have another bill passed, what would the bill be that you would like passed that you have right now?
It's kind of a tough one, but I think that the one that has gained the most traction, at least, is probably HB 4942. So it's a bill to close a marital rape loophole in Michigan. Currently, under Michigan law, it is legal to rape your spouse if you drug him or her first without their consent. I ended up with 62 co-sponsors, 11 of them being Republican, a fair amount of them being on the House Judiciary Committee as well. And the language is pretty tight. You know, occasionally there were conversations that I had to have where people were worried. You know, they made the slippery slope argument. But the language in this law is so ironclad. It's very clearly in cases where you drug a person without his or her consent.
And wow. Then, now, where did this come from? Where did this idea come from?
Actually, someone messaged me on Twitter and said, did you know that this is something that exists in the state of Michigan? There have been cases in other states where there were some pretty high-profile cases, in fact, where a woman had been assaulted and she found out because she was, you know, not feeling well at night. She'd wake up the next morning very groggy, couldn't remember what had happened. And then she found a number of videos and photos that her husband had taken where he was drugging her every night and then sexually assaulting her while she was unconscious.
Like date rape?
Yes.
Drug?
Oh, yes. And he was unable to be convicted because this same loophole existed in that state. So
you've been generating some support behind this, I imagine. Now, obviously, being in a competitive district, getting a bill passed in the House can be extremely difficult as being a person in the minority party. How have you been going about this, and how do you hope that you can get this passed?
I've had several conversations with Republican legislators, including the chair of the Judiciary Committee, Representative Graham Filler. He agreed that this is kind of a common sense bill. He and I have had a couple meetings about it, and he has said that he is interested in giving it a hearing. And in all honesty, I also flagged it for Speaker Chatfield and just said, you know, this is something I'm working on. I'm aware of the lay of the land, but I want you to know that this is something that's on the books, and there's a lot of support in this chamber to get this repealed. So.
Well, let's move on. Last subject I want to talk about, the presidential Democratic primary, obviously, is the big hot topic right now. I know you're supporting Elizabeth Warren, and she did very well in this most recent debate and looking for an upswing. First of all, let me ask you this. Will she still be a candidate by the time Michigan votes on March 10?
I absolutely think that Senator Warren's going to be a candidate, particularly after the debate last night. I think that that really reinvigorated a lot of her support and has gotten her a lot of attention, not just because of some of the things that were said, but again, the focus on her policies and the things that are important to her. You know, she talked about a lot of issues that need to be discussed, but often white candidates don't end up discussing things that matter to communities of color. And I think that that is really reinvigorating her base and bringing more people to it.
Now, why Elizabeth Warren as opposed to, let's say, Bernie Sanders or somebody else on the progressive end of things?
We have a number of really great candidates, but the reason that I ended up supporting Senator Warren is because I really, really appreciate her policy wonkiness, essentially. She actually does have very well thought out plans for, you know, everything that she proposes. So I appreciate someone who is forward thinking and, you know, wants to advocate for these policies and push for these progressive ideas. But I think it's really, really important to have an intentional plan behind them, too. Otherwise, we're just talking. And she's got those. And that's great.
You can't put them on a Post-it note.
You cannot put them on a Post-it note. And I think that's great.
Lori Potsky, state representative from the 19th District. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Well, we're going to close the podcast on that. Thank you, Jack and Kathy Barks-Hoffman, Mike, Brandon Dillon for coming in. This has been long awaited, too, by the way. We've been trying to get you for a long time. I'm glad that you're finally able to make it to MERS World Headquarters. Has it been everything that you thought it would be?
It's good. It's when me and Jack Spencer can agree on a lot of things, it's a good day.
So.
And of course, the boss, John Rurink. Glad to have him back. And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Moore. Take care.